This is session one of Developing Compassion for Humans, Animals, and All Life with Laura Kim Joyner.
I'm Laura Kim Joyner, and I'm in Gainesville, Florida, which is north central Florida. And what my hopes for tonight in the course is mostly it's just to provide space, a sense of spaciousness and a structure for people to come to understand themselves better and the different other, which in this case we're often talking about other species. I'd also like to open up some learning about animals and animal behavior. I'm not an animal behaviorist. I'm a wildlife veterinarian, but I hang around a lot of behaviorists. So I think this for me is a huge part of how I work with communication and other animals. Also some tools on how to grow our lives and feel like we belong in the family of things. And I want to learn from you all. This is all new stuff we're doing here. No one's really done this. It's a whole new paradigm about how we come as equals to relationships with other species, if you indeed feel that that is true for you. And so I want to learn from you all and also build community. One thing that I wanted to do is to get us oriented into this four-session class and sort of in some specifics what the intentions are. And I'm going to try this experiment. I'm going to try to tell my story of what brings me here tonight. And that way you can perhaps see what it is that I bring here and what resources I bring it out of and what my hopes are. So I have a number of slides, mostly of my work in Central America. Here's the deal. Since I was 4 years old, I wanted to be a wild bird veterinarian. That has been a driving force in my life. And I've mostly worked with parrots in Central America because they're very endangered and it's a very compelling part of the world for me. This is the area that I've worked in, Central America and the Caribbean and Northern South America, pretty much in this entire area. I've done that for 25 years, and I thought as a scientist, all you need to know was the science, you know, just the facts, ma'am, and that I could save the endangered birds of the world. And what I found in those 25 years is that, oh, no, you need to know so much more. Some of the work that I did is working with this species, the scarlet macaw, and she's just now coming out of her nest cavity. And we send people up to climb the tree so they can study the nest and so that they can study the chicks that are in the nest. And that was my specialty, was being able to determine how healthy is the environment and the parrot population by studying the parrots. And so these are young chicks about ready to fledge. We would temporarily take them out of their nest cavities and lower them down below and so I could study them. And we also study the wild adult birds. So we would spend a lot of time just studying the behavior and how well the parents were and how many birds there were in the area. And so what we found and what I'm still finding after 25 years in Central America is that the biggest risk to these parrots staying on the planet is humans. The biggest risk is people, and it's not so much from hunting. It's from people's desire to have parrots in their home with them. And so they steal them illegally from the nest cavities and bring them into the captive bird trade. And another piece that is a part of this is just the sociopolitical background of what's going on in Central America. From Guatemala, they are uncovering the mass graves still from the genocide there during the 80s when hundreds and thousands of people were killed and a million were displaced. And these people are just trying to return the bones to their homes and to document the atrocities of the genocide. And even still, those people have death threats against their life. So we're working in an area trying to save the birds when the people are in dire circumstances. And what's underneath so much of this in the part of the world, the political instability, is the poverty. it's the resources in the hands of the few. And so with this as a background, it makes it really hard to work on just the birds. You really have to work on the human factor as well. And so after working for many years in Central America, let me tell you the situation where it is today. One of the species that I worked with was the yellow-nape Amazon. And during the 90s, we had a sanctuary composed of three ranches. And my last year there, the ranchers decided to convert their cattle lots with these nest trees in the middle to sugarcane. So we literally were throwing ourselves in front of the tractor so they wouldn't take down these centuries-old trees where birds had been nesting for over 100 years. And we were not successful. And in the 15 years since that time, tree after tree has come down in the south coast of Guatemala. They say that Guatemala, the south coast, has been desaparecido, which in Spanish means it's been disappeared. So if you drive along the countryside today in Guatemala, you see sugarcane on both sides of the field and sugarcane fields in the distance. And in the north part of Guatemala, where at one time was the largest jungle forest outside of the Amazon basin, it's up where the Mayan people live, they have another problem that has come into the country, and this is drug trafficking. And what the drug traffickers do is, besides buying off the local politicians, is they move in communities illegally into the forest, burning the forest to plant crops. And they're not supposed to be there. We've lost 70% of the forest in the last 15 years in this part of Guatemala. And so now there's only a couple hundred scarlet macaws left in this country and each of the countries in Central America. Every bird, we're fighting for the life of every bird. The forest is burning down on either side of us. So as we go into work for the day, we literally have to hack with machete the trees out from our path into the forest to study the parrots. Put out fires as we go and use the last bit of our drinking water to douse what little fires that we can. And this isn't happening just in Guatemala, but it's happening all over Central America. And this last remaining population of scarlet macaws in the pine forest in Honduras, the second poorest country in Latin America. And there we work with an indigenous people called the Miskitans who work with us and climb the nest trees. And what's happening with them is people want their land. It's their ancestral lands, but they don't have a legal title to it. So people come in with brute force and machine guns and threaten the people. If they do not leave and abandon their villages, they will kill them. And indeed, Tomas, one of the people that I work with, was shot 4 times protecting his people and parrots. And he did survive. And I said, Tomas, you're back in the field with us. We had to hire the military to go in with us to protect you and to protect us. Why are you willing to risk your life? And he told me this. He said, everything is at risk. I am willing to risk everything. If we lose the birds, we lose our way of life. And I thought that was a really great truth for me that he spoke, that the saving of the people is the saving of the animals, and the saving of the animals is the saving of the people, and we must do both at the same time. The health of all of us is interrelated, and we need to take care of ourselves and take care of animals at the same time. And this isn't something that just I discovered. People all over the world are coming up with this idea, this quote, is the health of each group is inextricably interconnected. The challenges with this dynamic are demanding, profound, and unprecedented. And that, I think, is the challenge for our species in this day and age, is that we aren't going to make it unless all of us make it. And so we have to find ways to take care of ourselves and take care of people and animals that are very different from us. Our science is pretty good, but our social science of working with our own species is just now taking off. And as a scientist, I realized that I needed tools to work with human beings if I was going to try to save the animals, where so much of my attention was for. After I lived in Central America, I started looking for tools to help me deal with the human species, because I knew we needed to take care of humans. And that led me to divinity school and becoming a minister, a Unitarian Universalist minister. And it also drew me to nonviolent communication, where I am a certified trainer, because I thought, oh my gosh, that's a tool for people, and I believe we can also use it with non-human animals. I think it works the same. And so those are two of the basic tools that I looked for, and also a lot of science on animal behavior and communication, non-human animal as well as human animal. And so it's these tools that I want to offer to you that have made it possible for me to go back to Central America after 10 years of sort of healing from that experience, to go back and have more hope than ever. Because I really believe that it's possible for us to change our behavior so that we can be better stewards of the earth and all the animals on the planet. And that's my story. And so what I'd like to do now is pause, and perhaps one of you would like to comment on my story or ask questions. Maybe you would like to tell a story of what brings you here tonight, and also to lift up what tools you may have found to help you work with other species as well as the human species. So I'm kind of just throwing it open now for a little bit of chatting. And
one of the tools I have discovered is a program called Control Unleashed, which creates a two-way communication system between the animal and the human that empowers the animal to tell you if they're afraid of something, if they're worried about something, to show you what that object is or that person or that being, and then for you to go through counter-conditioning rituals that, you know, decrease that negative emotion, whatever that may be. That's something I'm terribly excited about, and I think would be awesome to bring to other animals other than dogs and cats and horses.
Well, I get really excited hearing that, too, and I'm wondering, it sounds very similar to how we're going to be working on some of the components in nonviolent communication. I want to invite you to comment on it, reflect on, or interject how that is similar or different from some of the things we'll be doing. I would like to learn more.
Okay, great.
Right, okay. And would anyone else like to talk about tools that you have for working with animals, or what tools you'd be interested in learning more about, perhaps?
What I'd like to learn is how to communicate, how to be more articulate. I can write, but I can't speak as well as I'd like to my group, because they think, oh, I just love animals. But my little church group doesn't seem to, I don't know, they put animals second and people first. And I don't see why it has to be either or. You can care about people and animals. And I just need to learn how to give a talk and make it clear, try to be clear on it, give them some things to think about.
We will be doing some practice that is communication not just with non-human animals, but with human animals, especially in the last session, the third and the fourth session. Especially the fourth one, we'll mostly be talking about talking to people. That's so much of how we deal with animals, is humans are associated with non-human animals. So I hope we can meet some of those needs for you of wanting to be clearer and to be heard.
Thank you.
Okay, so some of the tools that I found that helped me work in this field of trans-species relationships, of how I can come to every moment with an open heart and with compassion for all of life, is, I'll say the word spirituality and religion. Now, I had not planned to bring that in, that tool, here into this course. If you all say you'd like to know more about that, we can do that later. I do that in other courses, so I wasn't going to do it here, but I wanted to let you know that's a tool that I use for trans species work. And then the other pieces are emotional intelligence, social intelligence, trans species intelligence, and ecological intelligence. And what I'm doing with those four fields is I'm integrating it in a framework of nonviolent communication. Nonviolent communication is the basis of how I think about what I communicate and what goes on inside of me when I'm listening to another animal. So tonight, mostly, we're just going to be looking at the background of these four kinds of intelligences. It may be a review for most of you all, and I'll learn something, I hope, as well. But I wanted to give us this background because we rely on it in the way that I come at it, and nonviolent communication is the overlay. We're going to go through those four intelligences. Emotional intelligence. You may know of emotional intelligence through the work of Daniel Goldberg. And it's just the ability to identify, assess, and control the emotion of oneself, of others, or groups. And I'm not saying you necessarily want to control your emotions, but you want to be informed about them and have choice is I think, the better way to talk about it. And so that's what emotional intelligence is. And when we work with trans species, it's knowing what's going on inside of us and being able to guess what's going on inside of other animals. And so I just want to give you a little bit of a background of the evolution of emotions to talk about how tied we are to other animals through emotions. There was just an article in USA Today that talked about how brain imaging and brain scans are showing how similar our networks are. For instance, part of our brain lights up when we are afraid or happy. And so when we look at of the primates and the great apes, that we come from common ancestors. So our brains are pretty similar how they're wired and how they see emotions. And that's not just true of primates, but it's also true of going down through the other vertebrates and even into the invertebrates. And so I want to talk about is what it means to be a great ape, and humans are one of the great apes. And apes at one time in Africa lived in the jungle with monkeys. Monkeys have a tail and the apes don't. And what the monkeys did is they learned how to eat fruit that had not ripened yet. Apes had to move out for food, and the savanna was encroaching, so the apes had to go into the savanna. And what happened was it was really hard for apes to do that, because they were solitary animals. They did not imprint for a social hierarchy. So they didn't really associate with each other too much. You know, during breeding and in raising of the children a little bit. But mostly they stayed away from each other. They didn't really like each other or trust each other unless they had to. But then all of a sudden, our ancestors had to go out into the savanna and they had to grow this big brain to read emotions and to read social cues, bond together onto the savanna. So we had to rely on each other, and we weren't sure we really liked each other. We were competing with each other, and we also had to collaborate with each other. So our brains got fairly big to develop this social complexity, and yet we were still very much like our ancestors. So we are both like and unlike all other species. And the same can be said of every other species, too. They are both like and unlike other species. So I just wanted to give us that background of emotional intelligence so we could say, well, what do animals feel? And I'm including us, too. So that some people put feelings into four basic categories. And three of them rhyme, and so you probably know this. So what do other species feel? Well, they feel various levels of mad. Here's an elephant that's in a rage, that is angry. And we've maybe all seen films of that or pictures of that. And we maybe have seen dogs and cats angry. We may have experienced anger ourselves. And I think you could also put irritation and perhaps frustration in this group. What do other species feel? Well, they feel glad, and happiness and satisfaction comes in here. And recently, they've done some studies on iguanas, where iguanas have something called body fever, that when they experience what we would imagine as happiness or satisfaction, like moving towards a warm light or having a meal, their bodies warm up. And that's a sign of expression of an emotion or satisfaction as they move towards a heat lamp or move towards food. So even our reptile brains have connections back into an emotional life. Other species can also feel sad or mourning or grief, depression. This is a slide of black-billed magpies. And the author Mark Beckhoff talks about a time he saw a magpie that had been hit by the side of the road. And the magpies came and dropped pieces of grass and leaves on top of the body of the magpie before they flew off one by one. And he asked, were they sad? Were they feeling grief? And we've seen this kind of behavior in crows as well in elephants when a member of the herd dies. And I've seen it myself with birds in captivity that when the mate dies, the other mate will become depressed in attitude and will quit eating and drinking for a number of days. And then the last one that doesn't rhyme is afraid. Mad, glad, sad, and afraid. And I think we can recognize this in dog and in canine species with the lowered back in and the ears down especially and the tail in a subordinate position, that they feel afraid. Those are just four broad categories. There are many other that add different groups of emotions, and you can tie each of these emotions into brain patterns. And this is where I was telling you they're beginning to say that in the area where we light up for anger, other animals are doing the same way with the way their brains light up. This is just a longer list of what Plutnik, the author Plutnik, calls as his group. And it's just showing disgust. And I think if any of y'all have had dogs, you've seen looks of anticipation when they have a chance to go for a walk. So what I want to suggest is that we probably need a list of what animals feel for each species of animal. We're challenged to become more efficient in what animals feel, and not just what species feel, but what each individual feels. And so what I want to do is just show a short video of chimpanzees, and it shows that they can feel an emotion. And after you see it, I want you to guess what emotion you think that it is. And then we're going to have a chance afterwards for us all to just chat and share about emotions that we've seen in animals. So let's try to get this video up and going. So what emotion did those animals feel?
Curiosity.
And fear.
Fear. Yeah, they were startled, weren't they?
Yes.
What I want to ask, how many of you all jumped when the chimpanzees jumped? Did you feel it when they jumped?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Where did you feel it in your body? Part of our emotional intelligence is, oh, well, what am I feeling now? And so where in your body did you feel it?
I felt it in my legs.
Was it like tingling or did they tighten up?
They tightened.
Okay, and how about you?
My stomach, it tightened.
I have to tell you, I've seen this video 10 times, and my stomach still lurched, and I jump when they jump.
Yeah, and I felt it across my chest.
Oh, okay. I want to come back. You said you felt sorry for them. What? Would you be willing to say more about...
Yes, what I felt, how cruel to frighten them with that noise, and I just thought they were so peaceful, and now look what's happened.
You were able to pick out what you were feeling or what humans might feel and guess that that's what they might have been feeling and what their needs might be. And what might their needs be?
They needed to feel safe again.
Well, sure. And we could say they needed to rest and peace. We can make a guess by watching them and by also feeling in our own body what's going on with other animals. So before I go on, I wonder if anyone else wants to lift up emotions that they've seen in other animals. We're going to go into this in much more detail next week. But I thought maybe something was just alive in you that you'd like to share with the group.
My dog is so afraid of thunderstorms, and I don't know what to do to help her because she had a terrible experience as a young dog before I got her.
So she really has a lot of fear because she wants safety.
Yeah.
Right. You might want to work on that as we move through possibilities or actions. That may not be alive for you, but we'll be going forward and saying, well, when we guess at the need of an animal, how do we know that we've got the need right? And then how do we receive that as a request of what we might be able to do with them? What does it mean? Do we have to take care of them when there's a thunderstorm, or can we just let them deal with it? We're going to talk more about that, how we deal with the responsibility we feel with other species. Your hand's up next.
I think that with dogs, we have a pretty good ethogram in terms of their emotions, and while the majority of the people are not able to read it, and while some of them are individual signs, I think we're getting better and better at communicating to people common signs of stress and common signs of joy. You know, intuitive owners get it anyway, but not everybody is like that. Yeah, I have a lot of hope, and I think that dogs are just like us. I think they feel depression, they feel joy, they feel frustration, they feel jealousy. I've not seen an emotion in a human that I can't see in a dog.
So I guess you're pretty hopeful that we're figuring some of this out so we can have people become more educated and we can take better care of dogs.
Yeah, I'm a Steven Pinker fan, and that's his message. And certainly in my 15 years of being a professional dog behavior consultant, I've seen things, for the most part, move away from violence and towards communication and cooperation. Shock collars are being made illegal in many countries. Choke chains and prong collars are being outlawed in many countries. And the trend towards training in this country is also becoming more and more positive.
Thank you for sharing that. I can connect to that positive hope. That felt good to share. Anyone else?
Yes, I too think that especially dogs share a lot of our emotions. And I was working with a family. They have two dogs, and one passed away. And I watched the grief of the other dog. Wouldn't lay on the dead dog's bed, wouldn't go near its dish, was just grief-stricken for a couple weeks. But I did notice as the family came out of it, the dog came out of it a little bit better, too. I think our emotions are kind of intertwined with the owner, and especially with dogs. As they're feeling better, the dog began to feel better also. But I did watch his grief. It was as painful as it was to watch the human.
And I guess it shouldn't surprise us, since we've been evolving together for, some people feel, 100,000 years, that part of our DNA has probably been impacted by being around dogs so much in our history. All right, so that's emotional intelligence. And then I wanted to say a little bit about social intelligence. It's very similar to emotional intelligence, but it means that we're able to negotiate and traverse relationships. And it's got to do with what we're thinking and what we're feeling. And there's been quite a lot of bit of about that out there about people. You see it in the business world. There's lots of books and seminars you can take on this. And one of the reasons why I stress social intelligence, because this isn't all about what's going on with the animals. Communication is a two-way street, so we want to know what's going on inside of us, and we're social beings, is that if we're getting better at knowing what the emotions and the status and the behavior of others are, we can deliver better care in more ambiguous situations. This was a study, it was a human doctor study, and they said the more socially intelligent people were able to deliver a higher quality and greater period of time that they could deliver care. And for me as a veterinarian and working in wildlife conservation, that really got my attention, that, oh, I really need to be smart about people, because we need this to be able to care for animals and for ourselves when the going gets tough. So one of the pieces about social intelligence is the somewhat innate ability we have to read facial expressions. you've probably heard the statistic that 90% of human communication is paraverbal or nonverbal. Paraverbal, we mean tone of voice. Oh, you pretty little dog, versus, oh, you pretty little dog. And nonverbal would be body language, facial expressions. That's how we're picking up signals for others. Only 10% of it is verbal. The problem is with other animals, we may not be as attuned into their facial expressions because they have other ways of communicating. And so what this has brought up is a field that's just growing called cognitive ethology. It's just a big word, but it means studying the thinking and emotional lives of animals. It's helping us, like how we're getting better at dogs. That's really cognitive ethology. What are they thinking and feeling? And what goes on not just in one species, but within one individual? The problem is that in the past, we didn't pay much attention to this because, well, we just didn't think that they were as complex as we thought they were. And we're saying, well, we don't possibly know what an animal is thinking, so why would we worry about it? Well, we can't really tell what we're thinking, let alone what another person is, and yet we know that thinking and emotional intelligence is really important. So much more research has been done in recent years so that we can start saying, yes, they do have emotions, and here's what we think they are. Anybody want to guess what's going on with that bird? What emotion is that bird feeling? He's taking a bath.
He's feeling pleasure.
We could guess that. And we'd also have to say, well, they don't have facial expressions like we do or body movements. So how do we know that for sure? And so the field of cognitive ethology goes and finds that out. We want to find out whether the birds are feeling glad or whether they're angry. And we want to confirm what our guesses are telling us. So I want to give you an example of how we've made errors in the past and how we're all still subject to these errors of how we think about animals. Have you ever heard the term bird brain? It used to be, oh, even 20 years ago, that we thought birds weren't very smart, and the scientists thought that too, because the birds don't have a very well-developed cortex like we do, the frontal cortex where we do a lot of our complex thinking. They don't have it. So they thought that birds, all the behavior they were seeing couldn't be right. Well, a paper came out a little over 10 years ago, and they said it's something called convergent evolution, that birds developed another part of their brain called the pallidium, and that's where they do their complex thinking, and it's rather quite large for a brain that size. And so they said, uh-oh, we were wrong. Birds really can do complex thinking. And so it spurred on all the behaviorists to go out and study birds. And the more we look at them, the more we go, oh, my gosh, there's a whole bunch going on in birds. Every month there's another major paper or another book. And this book, The Gifts of the Crow, just came out about showing how complex are birds in the family of the crows. And I just want to show you a couple videos of that so you can get an idea of what we didn't think was possible 10 years ago, and now we realize, oh, there's quite a lot going on. So here's one thing about birds, and I want you to guess what the bird might be feeling or what the bird is doing. Anybody want to hazard a guess? Okay, what's the crow feeling?
Joy. That's a blast.
Yeah. Playing, right? Yeah, what are you going to say?
Yes, I was going to say playful. He's really playful.
You know, crows have been doing that for millennium, and we just now noticed it. We just started writing about it and making videos of it. What would you like to say?
I see that this crow has made up a game on his own. He's invented this game.
Right, so maybe there's a lot of thinking going on. Maybe there's some pride or a sense of accomplishment. There's some self-awareness going on there with the crow?
Yes.
Okay.
Can I tell a quick story about my cockatiel?
We are all about stories because that is one way to know feelings and needs and to understand our world. So please do.
every night when it's time for her cage to be covered, and you go to the cage with the little blanket, she turns upside down and flaps her wings and does a performance, and we all have to clap and go, wow! And then in a few seconds, she's finished.
What feelings and needs can you guess are going on with your cockatiel?
I don't know whether it's a habit that she started and relates to the cover, or whether she loves to hear the excitement and that we're paying extra attention. I'm not sure what it is.
I really appreciate you saying, I don't know, and that open curiosity and that curiosity of being wrong. We don't have to guess right to give empathy towards animals. We just have to try. And we might be wrong, but we're open to that guess. And we'll find out later how we can work with that to see how it might be for the benefit of everybody involved. Okay, so I have another video also about crows. And you may have seen this before, but if you hadn't, I wanted to just kind of show you about crows using tools. This is actually in a laboratory where they study crows. So he's got a straight piece of wire trying to get that white hook out, that white piece of plastic out. So what's that crow doing and thinking and feeling?
I think there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. I'm a clicker trainer, so of course I believe that animals are way smarter than what we give them credit for. I own an email list called Animals Learning Concepts, and clearly the crow is showing the understanding of even the consistency of what she's holding in her beak. I know that the scientists totally freaked out over that because they were like, oh, well, she was able to determine that she could bend the tool.
You know, before we might have heard that, oh, that's just a behavior that they're born with and they're not thinking about it. But mm-hmm. now with the fields of cognitive ethology, they can set it up and you can watch the birds reason it out and learn from each other and develop new tools that'll fit different pieces that they do. I had the opportunity one time to watch a crow. It was just a straight stick, but she was using it to get at insects in a ant hill. And I said, oh, my gosh, look at that. I actually got to see a crow using a tool. There's so many research out there and so many books out there, and you all are probably as connected to it as I am, or more so, but I'd like us to give us a chance about maybe some new and unusual behaviors that we've seen in animals close to us that might be new for us or something that we would like to just share with each other. And I have a whole long list of all the various behaviors out there, but this is just a chance to share. And this is just a picture of an alligator close to my home here in Florida about how female alligators will protect their young alligators, and they'll stay with each other for the first couple of months of life. So we may say that there's some sense of nurturance and protection and a sense of safety and some understanding of that going on. Anybody else want to share?
I saw a program. The people said that only dogs and cats can, when you point to something, respond. But I have deer who come to my house, and if I put down an apple and they didn't see where I put it and I point, the deer will go follow where my finger is pointing. And I thought that was amazing, just as a dog would. She followed my finger.
One thing that I've learned in my learning about other species is that when I hear someone say, only humans do this, or only this species does that, you set yourself up to be wrong. Would anybody
else?
Yeah,
and the pointing and gazing stuff, that's already been shown that it's definitely not the result of domestication. Wolves are capable of doing it too. And what I would argue, although I cannot prove it, is that it's the result of eye orientation, which in my opinion, most mammals are capable of understanding that I see. And that if you look somewhere, that you're looking at something, and thus they follow your gaze. So the deer may or may not have followed your point. They may have actually followed your gaze.
Anyone else like to share?
I have a girlfriend that taught her dog a language board. So a language board is a board that enables an animal to communicate. So she put cards on the board for water, for treat, for food, for walks, for playtime, and her dog pulls them off the Velcro and gives them to her, which means I want that now.
Alex, the African gray parrot, because they can mimic, they can actually do English words instead of pulling off of a language board. They speak some full sentences. I want water. I want to play. That bird was able to do that. Well, a piece of this is that we can be wrong about what we think is going on. And we're just doing our best bet to guess. So one part for me in communicating with animals is to know how they communicate. What are the studies in the wild, or if they're a domesticated species? What is the work that's going on out there? So I can augment what my best guess is with actual knowledge and expertise. And so I'm going to do a broad overview of how animals communicate and compared to the great apes on how we communicate. One way that animals communicate is with light and vision. So colors and color patterns, and they change colors, and bioluminescence, which is what this firefly is doing, is also what a lot of sea creatures do in the ocean. Being transparency, and then posture and movement, such as pointing, would be an example of that. And do you all know what a firefly is? If you have fireflies where you live, what fireflies are telling you when they light up like that? What I read is that what they're doing is they're telling predators that they don't taste very good. I'm drawing all this from this book of Principles of Animal Communication. And so the point that I would lift up is that we don't see in some of the ranges that other animals communicate in or can discern the subtle complexity going on. So there's a whole world of communication that isn't readily available to us, that it's harder for us. We have to make an effort to be able to see, and we have to be a scientist to be able to see that they see, for instance, birds and bees see in the ultraviolet light. So they're colored and they move and do things with ultraviolet structural colors that we can't even pick up. We have to use special lights and color spectrum analyzers to pick up on it, to know what it is that they're seeing and doing.
Isn't it like the ultrasound or ultrasonic that dolphins use and stuff? We can't hear that either.
Right, and I was going to put that in another category, but that's exactly right. The whales, you know, and I was kind of putting that up into sound, that vibrations such as a rattlesnake or underwater vibrations, vocalizations, and just noise such as a crab claw clapping. And, you know, we all know that dogs hear much higher than we do, and whales hear really, really higher than we do. So, again, we kind of get stuck because we can't always hear in the range that they do or discern subtle complexity. Like we might hear a warbler, a little bird singing, and actually what the female is hearing, how fit that bird is and what the territory is, and we cannot discern that because we can't hear the subtle changes or know what they mean. And I wonder if anybody else has any other examples of animal communication and sound?
Dogs bark different barks, and they all mean stuff.
They sort of have a language with their barks, is that right?
Mm-hmm. They would say it's not language because there's no grammar, but I would argue it's language. Prairie dogs will call to each other, and they can identify the size of the predator, how rapidly it is approaching, and they can say those things to each other. They'll be like, eh, 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 and that means, you know, coming on quick from the north, you know, then they all take shelter.
Yes, and parrots and crows, they found, I would argue that we could call it language in the wild too, that they can say, person with gun coming from the north, but he never shoots the gun. I mean, they're quite complex.
Wow.
Okay, here's another way that animals communicate, is with smell and chemical signals. You may have heard the word pheromones, that's how we usually call it, but I'm talking about smell and taste. And again, humans don't we didn't evolve to perceive what other species are perceiving. And ants have the most number of discrete pheromone glands of any other animal. And so they can tell each other incredible amounts of information by the secretions from the glands that they leave along the trail or when they touch or taste one another. So we may not be able to read other animals' pheromones, and they can't read ours, but humans also have a fair number of pheromones. I wonder if any of you all can recall any examples of how we communicate with smell to one another.
Mothers and babies.
There may be certain smells there and pheromones for bonding there. You're suggesting it's maybe part of the cycle?
Yes.
Well, it's certainly true. They've done studies between men and women and between adults that you can sense more emotional warmth and be able to read emotions better if the other person is emitting a certain kind of pheromone. And attraction, women can often predict who they'll get along by smelling the armpit of clothes of men. And then also pheromones are at play for the synchronized cycle of women's menses. The menstrual cycle regulated is through pheromones. So there's a lot going on in us. It just happens to be different or maybe mostly different from every other species. Maybe not. Maybe we share some in common and we just haven't found them yet. If we could learn to smell and taste what ants are discharging, we might know that they're angry and ready for a fight and are not a friendly species, like they can tell each other. And I also want to lift up that our subconscious is perceiving things that we're not aware of. So we're communicating in all kinds of ways that aren't reaching our frontal lobe, that we may not be able to read it and make sense of it, but our body knows. And that's a piece of when I do seminars with nonviolent communication is really tuning into our bodies, because maybe we're picking up pheromones, but we can't tell that we are until we see that our body is suddenly relaxing, maybe more at ease around certain people, and that may be what we're picking up. And we can look to our bodies and our facial expressions to see what it is we're learning from our subconscious. Finally, another way that animals communicate is short range, which would be touch, like when a sea lion uses their whiskers to see where the wake of a prey item has gone ahead of them. And then electroreception would be what a lot of fish and eels do, that they communicate to each other through electricity. And here's an example of an echina, which is from Australia and New Zealand. They pick up electrical currents through their nose. They stick their snout down in the ground, and they could pick up electrical currents of other species that they could eat. So that's just an example of that. And so, again, I want to pause and see if anybody has any examples of any of these three ways of communicating.
Sometimes a cat will wake you up by touching your face with the claws retracted. To communicate, to get up and get moving and get me my breakfast. They touch you with the paw.
And they're communicating something by not having the claws out.
Yes, it's, of course, I don't know how they figured that out or what the claws out mean.
I would guess that the claws out may be more of a playful or a defensive or a threat. Well, all of this on animal communication, you can see how in humans, we don't have all the ability of every other species to communicate as they do. And that leads me into trans-species intelligence. It's using everything we can to figure out how to understand other animals, how they're communicating and what they're communicating. And we're doing this so that we can benefit ourselves and that other species can benefit. So this is a trans-species intelligence, and I wanted to spend some time on trans-species intelligence and relationships. And one way that I would like to maybe provoke the conversation is to show you a video that I made. Most of the slides are from some books that have been put out about trans-species relationships. So most of the slides in this slide program are from those books, where people, where animals across species lines have spontaneously formed a relationship with one another. Some of the pictures are more posed. And you can see that maybe it wasn't a spontaneous relationship. So as we look at this, I'm going to invite you to be aware of your own emotions and what comes up for you watching it and what it may teach you about trans-species relationships. And also what we may need to be careful about when we assume we know what's going on with other species. And it slides put to a bridge over troubled water. So if you have sound, make sure it's turned up so you can hear it. I invite any of you all to share what that video brought up for you and feelings or what you perceived.
I like to think of it as the peaceable kingdom, but I noticed that either it was young animals together or the predators had to be very well fed to be able to be in some of those photographs with the what would be their prey. It was very touching.
So you feel it's possible for predator and prey, the lamb and the lion, to lie down together, but it may not be the first instinct that comes out in predator and prey?
Yes. They either have to be raised together or kept together in artificial, like a zoo or maybe or a animal park, and well fed. That's just what I was thinking.
One of the pieces that I meant to say with making that video is what you said, is if we're well fed, predator and prey can lie down together. And I think that's so true of our species, that democracy is most the economic and the basic needs of people are met. And if we can meet our own needs, better able to rise to compassion for others, be they our species or other species. And so that's why so much of, I feel that our work of compassion for other animals and for others is in working to get our own needs met, us as individuals and as a species. And I also wanted to say that we have the neural wiring to be very, very compassionate with animals that either we don't trust or that we want to eat. And so do other species. We have it deeply within us. We could set up the circumstances and be emotionally and socially and trans-species intelligent. We can actually manipulate that wiring or invite others to do so, so that we can have more compassion within our own species and across species lines. And that's my hope with this course. And that's what I was trying to lift up with that video, of how we have so much in common with the other species around us, and it is a bright hope. Well, Lucy, you kind of brought up something I've learned of what I see, the two kinds of mistakes that we humans tend to make. And I call it a continuum of errors because we're all on different lines of this depending on the species we're dealing with. We tend to overestimate how much we are like other species. We think that dogs are thinking exactly like we are, and we project entirely the human, emotional, social world onto what's going on for them. And we say they are us, and they're like us, and we don't always know that. We can make a good guess. That's one way that we make an error of this. And I'll just lift this up. We often hear how dogs have unconditional love for us. Well, I just wonder what else might be going on other than unconditional love. Maybe it's loyalty. Maybe it's affection. Maybe it's connection. You know, how do we know that it's the complex emotional love? How do we know that? Unless we do some studies and know more about what's going on with brain scans, how do we know? Well, we don't know if other people truly love us either unless they tell us. And even then, they could be unsure and wrong about themselves. So I'm not telling you that we shouldn't project ourselves onto them. I'm just saying we tend to make that error. And the other end of that is probably the more common error, or at least the historical error, is we think that we're not like them at all, that there's something very different about humans. The difference between humans and a non-human animal is fundamentally different than one species to another species. And this comes out of Plato and Aristotle, the great chain of being, that it was clearly demarcated that humans were very different than animals, that, and you were closer to God or a more evolved being the further away you got away from animals and got closer to God. And so this is the error we tend to make where we say they're not at all like us. We don't even assume that we know what's going on with them. And I believe that that's the continuum of errors that we make. And even though our science is much better today, I think it still behooves us to be aware of these errors. So I wanted to give you two examples of this with dogs. And the first one is an error where we maybe think they're a lot like us and they really aren't. And you may have seen this video. 12 million people saw it on YouTube. And it's where they take a dog behavior and they dub in human words. And maybe we think that's really what dogs are telling us. So that may be overestimating what they understand from us. And I want to show you, it's the dog Chaser that owes 1,022 nouns. And it reminds me of the language board you were talking about, Angie. So I want to show this too. It invites us for us to discover all that dogs and other animals can do. And I really lift up the part where they said that bonobos don't want to please us, and whereas dogs do. So much of what we understand from other animals is in relationship. And if we don't have a relationship with them, it's really hard to understand what's going on or whether there is any relationship there with which to communicate. And I know that birds are often like that, that they learn best in social context because that's how they're wired. And so just doing a recording doesn't matter near as much as if another person or another bird is actually saying the word to them in some type of social puzzle context. So I just sort of wanted to pause there and lift up the two continuum of errors and want to know if anybody has any comments on that.
My personal opinion is that I'm more worried about dehumanization of dogs or animals than humanization. When I work with clients, if they have projected something, it's usually pretty easy to help them figure out that that wasn't what the dog was really saying. I see the bigger problem as labeling and dehumanizing. You know, he's dominant, therefore he should be shocked. He's vindictive and he needs to be punished. So I'm for the knowledge that we learned from the Stanford Prison Experiment and from the Stanley Milgram studies that should include animals as well as humans, that labeling and dehumanizing can be incredibly damaging.
Right. So since we've had the error tends to mostly go the other direction, you allow some room and encourage it almost to go ahead and go for it.
Mm-hmm. I just thought of a quick example. I once found a dog who was lost, and when I returned her, the man wanted to hit her. And I said, don't think about it. It's your fault, not her fault. And he didn't, but that was his first horrible instinct. What Angie said made me think of that.
So I really love to honor time commitments. So I want to stop us now and do a checkout. And we'll finish the rest of the slides when we come back. So next week what we're going to do is we'll continue with the science learning that we've done, and then we're going to do trans-species empathy, where we really have the chance to go into detail about what's going on with us and with other species. And there's a journal exercise for that. And I just want to give people a chance to check out, what are you taking with you from this time together? Any celebration or any mourning?
I'm really excited to find this work because I've been thinking about cross-species communication and also extending empathy to ecosystems. So I was really excited to find you doing this work. So thanks. I'm looking forward to next week.
Laura, do you want to do a checkout?
Yeah. See what I'm taking away. Laura Kim, at the very beginning when you spoke about, you know, just widening your lens from animal well-beings and seeing how we're interconnected and how the well-beings of the animals were connected with the well-being of the humans around. I was really inspired by that.
For my checkout, I want to say that I learned some pieces, and we're about ready to go next week off into the inner world as it uses trans-species intelligence, and I'm really looking forward to it based on what you all have shared with me with your interest and what you know. I think I'm going to learn a lot, and we're going to learn a lot together, and so I'm really excited about that, and that's what I'm taking with me. And I just have some closing words to send us off on our way from Wendell Berry. When despair for the world grows in me, when I wake in the night at the least sound and fear of what my life or my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water. And I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time I rest in the grace of the world and am free. And what I want to say is, Wendell Berry, how do you know that they don't tax their lives with forethought of grief? They do know the future, several species do. So I'm going to call you on that. But your main point, I agree with it. If we go and lie down and rest and be with the other, we can rest in the grace of the world to which we belong and find great freedom in that knowing and great compassion. Thank you.